I would also be happy to discuss more about what I presented this morning as you want, but I have also prepared a very small set of things that I could throw at the blackboard, and then people can discuss about it concerning fluid turbulence.
Can I still ask regarding the monitoring?
Please, yeah, sure.
So if you said that using the first order hydrodynamics leads to problems in solving in practice, so what happens if you try to solve it in practice?
What happens is that you get high wave number modes, so short wavelength excitations that grow exponentially, which overwhelm your geometric flow. So you start with very small fluctuations, they just grow very fast and destroy your...
What you were discussing, you only discussed the fact that signals propagate.
Yes. Yeah, it's so...
There was no sign of any instability.
Yes. There are some claims saying that those two are related, but so there's one paper specifically by Hiscock and Lindblom who takes that first order formalism and shows that then you get instabilities if you go to a essentially moving frame or so, and that is cured if you go to the second order formalism. It's not so easily understandable that I did present it.
So it's clearly an exponential, not a power law. So it's not related to secularity.
No, it's really exponential. Exponential of square root maybe, but
it's really some mode out of this dispersion curve is the wrong time.
Yes.
Because I was afraid that if you write more and more terms, cascade will have higher order, because polynomial for the poles, and we get some wrong poles.
You put these kind of instabilities in scalar theories too. If you choose a too high time discretization, isn't it similar here? So if you choose a smaller time step?
No, that doesn't help you. No. So and you can also see in the numerics, if you go with this second order relaxation time, if you choose two small values, then the thing just blows up. If you're in the safe region, then you're fine. And as you approach the critical value of this coefficient, you can see that it gets harder numerically. And indeed, you have to choose smaller and smaller time step increments to still make something sensible out of it. But at some point, there's just gets intractable numerically.
But when you say it's not clear, the nature of that, I mean, that it's apparent in practice, but the nature is not quite clear. That means it's not, it doesn't appear in linear order, or it does?
What did you?
I mean, if you perturb, if you linearize.
Yes, there is where you see it. Yeah.
You see it.
Yes. So, are there more questions concerning this morning, or should I just talk about?
There is another thing which I want to mention, that is, of course, when there would be Librinsky, he will speak about it, maybe something. I just say what the idea is. The idea is that what Paul is doing and others, they're expanding in power of K. In this ADS business, you can calculate next order. But you can also calculate a complete quasi-normal modes. There are these quasi-normal modes, omega of k, and one of these modes, small k and small omega, is a sound. It has a sound pole. So it has an imaginary part, which is this I in eta k squared, and it goes into complex plane. The question is, what happened with this mode later? Ordinary Navier-Stokes, if theta is just constant, have this dispersion curve. And there are two solutions, plus and minus, which make kind of a circle and then collide. So above certain k, it's complete nonsense. It's obviously that Navier-Stokes become complete nonsense above certain k. The quasi-normal mode as a function of k actually goes in a complex plane, increase the imaginary power, then it turns and goes asymptotically toward the real axis again. And when that happens, when k over t is about 1. And what it means is that the dispersion curve of a solid, at least, is such that its effective imaginary part is less than the Navier-Stokes theorem. When k over t is about 0.5 or 1. Mm-hmm. And so we think maybe it is related to the fact that that we see effectively smaller eta. Because our k over t at initial time is like 0.5.
But that is precisely saying that if I plot on my horizontal axis, let's say the strength of the term that generates shear viscosity for me, namely the gradient of velocity, and then look at what my shear tensor does, then obviously at very small gradients, k if you want, this linear behavior here, this the proportionality coefficient is just my eta. And what you're arguing is that if I go out sufficiently in k, this thing turns around somewhat. So what I'm arguing is that, well, we know in n equals strongly coupled n equals 4 what that coefficient is, but we now also know what is the second correction to it. That's precisely the second order transport coefficients that I was talking about. And it turns out that if you put them into a real simulation, the dependence of those coefficients on the V2 that you see is kind of small. It's not quantitatively important.
Yes, I have nothing against it. I'm just saying that what we look at this thing without expanding k, and qualitatively the argument is the same direction.
Yeah.
That it could be going this way or that way or whatever.
Yeah.
We may not believe next coefficient, which by some random reason can happen wrong or something like this. But just the complete behavior is indeed like constant.
Except that I'm arguing that you're...
But you're saying it's not too important.
Yeah, because if we were really out in that region here, then I would argue it would make a huge difference what kind of value I choose for that coefficient, because, well, that difference here would show up in my simulation.
So, Paul, remind us, you, in your second order terms, you actually had in place this one term, which is effectively a relaxation term.
Yeah.
But you also had these
adequate
nonlinears, these self-interaction terms.
Yeah.
Were the latter important?
So the kappa obviously is not important because we're in a system that has vanishing Ricci and Riemann tensor.
Right.
The vorticity coupling is not important because it's zero in n equals 4.
So
it's zero in weakly coupled theories. The shear tensor vorticity coupling is not important because in ideal hydrodynamics, I have conservation of vorticity in two dimensions. So the only other term that could be important is the self-coupling of shear tensor to shear tensor.
Mm-hmm.
And I checked that there is a small dependence, but it's smaller than the dependence on the relaxation term.
Could it also be that in this term, for instance, that is identically zero, and where we don't know why this is, because we actually don't know if there's a symmetry behind, could it be that if you go to third order, fourth order, and so on, it's always zero, but then you sum up all orders, and it pops up to be non-zero? This is, for instance, when you have critical exponents in a second order phase transition. In each order, say, perturbation theory, you would find it's identically zero. And then you resum it with an order, and you get a non-zero result.
I definitely cannot comment about arbitrary high-order coefficients. But the coefficient or the term that I was interested in is precisely of second order in gradients. And for that coefficient, it's zero both at strongly coupled n equals 4 and weakly coupled system. It may certainly be true that there's a third order term which involves triple coupling of vorticities that might turn out to be non-zero. But yeah, about that I cannot make any statement.
It's correct what you were saying, and if it were bent over and you see such a small second order coefficient.
Complicated vertices are just zero by.
Yes, because they are linear.
But it's not that what you're asking is not interesting. One can think of some vortex solutions, and then it would be important.
Good.
Maybe there is a VSFT solution dual to it.
Yeah, I mean there are interesting things you can do. Certainly.
But you can write down a Kubo relation for those coefficients.
Yes, so except that for the nonlinear terms, of course, it's more complicated.
So you can see what property of the energy momentum tensor you need in order to have non-zero.
Yeah. Right.
So, I want to sort of switch gears a little bit, if that's appropriate.
Can I stand still and hold still? So if you go to non-relativistic limit, do you go again to non-relativistic second-order equations?
I don't have any masses in my treatment, so I cannot really go to non-relativistic systems.
You don't have any additional conserved current that you need to define.
Yes.
I see, and you didn't derive it. I mean, you need another equation, right?
Sure. If you want to have conserved currents, then the equations will have to take that into account.
So I wanted to get your thoughts on sort of the big picture looking forward.
Mm-hmm.
One of your messages one could arguably view as sort of frustrating, that uncertainties of the initial conditions are as or more important than the influence of viscous terms that we'd like to, you know, fix. So you did this nice calculation. It's done. Is it all over?
No, obviously not.
What's it really going to teach us? Things that could be done in the future.
So, first of all, I would say that, well, there is, of course, a big uncertainty coming from, for example, the initial conditions concerning whether we can expect the bound to be violated or not at Rigg. But it's remarkable that the values you get out for viscosity, even for these arguably very different initial conditions, is all in this very small region, 0 to 0.2. And that's already, I think, something remarkable, because it could as well have been, in some sense, 0.5.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, maybe not 1, but large. And obviously, the task now is to identify a possibility of deciding not only what the viscosity is, but also what the initial conditions are at the same time. And one thing that is maybe possible in that framework is to look at, well, as I said, other pieces of data, for example, V2 fluctuations, where it might be possible to discriminate at the same time what initial conditions and what viscosity is best suited to model Rigg data. And then you could make much stronger statements about, well, on which side on the bound we actually find ourselves at Rigg or not.
There is one idea, by the way, which was kind of circulating. The problem with this stuff is that you have very large and nice hydro system for central collisions, but then V2 is zero kinematically. If you want V2 to be large, you go to peripheral collisions, then you have system becomes smaller, and there are fluctuations, and there are all kinds of questions about its shape, because you calculate it from Glauber, etc. It would be nice to have a system which you know what shape it has.
Yes.
So that was the idea, to collide strongly deformed nuclei. For example, uranium. Uranium is 40% deformed. But unfortunately, you cannot make a beam of polarized or even oriented. But a posteriori, you can fix the geometry by, you want them to collide like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have very well defined eccentricity of the system. So you know epsilon.
Yes.
Do you really know epsilon?
Yes, nuclear physics knows the shape of uranium very well.
Also at high energy conditions? Could there be a color glass inside your uranium atoms? or nuclei.
So
your eccentricity again goes out of the window.
But the profile may be different, but kind of, it's no longer related to this overlap in shape. It is just shape of nuclei itself.
Yeah, yeah, but even that changes if you assume that it's pure Wood-Sachsen or it's colored glass condensate.
So you say,
Maybe that is not true. Let me think.
Because you see, if it is elliptic already,
so you're looking at central collisions.
How exactly is it
far
is a different issue.
You would have the whole distribution of shapes because they would be colliding this way and that way, that way.
Right. But you might pick up 1% of the highest multiplicity.
No, 1%.
No. So you can against this is easy to make anti,
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Everything which collides like this have some spectators. You may have beta on all spectators, zero spectators.
Yes.
That's already, so that could be this way, but then it could be this way, and some other, so it's a complicated thing. Yes. But the principal idea that you may collide something which is already deformed and you know its shape, and you might say there are all shapes, but again, if you know the distribution exactly, that this elliptic thing rotates and is absolutely random oriented. So that will reduce ambiguity in principle.
So, if and when you have uranium data, and the deformation is not very big,
6%. Well, you can select whatever nuclei, it works for all nuclei. So you select the most deformed nuclei in the world.
I did that in practice. I did simulations on that, really nasty.
Okay, so maybe.
See how you got on the
rules. Maybe I don't understand something correctly, but can you make something like that of. Working out what would be the distribution after starting point, see whether there's some sort of consistency.
So you want to
take me
the initial conditions and change them such that I would reproduce data even better?
No,
or?
I'm saying whether you start with the initial condition.
Yeah.
And then you recalculate the initial condition for an intermediate time. And see whether there is some consistency.
I'm not sure if I understand. You want
so
to
if you started completely the wrong initial condition,
you
solve the equation for some time,
whether
it would adjust itself to what it wants to be.
No, it doesn't do that. So if you start with a different initial condition, for example, I always mix them up. There's this participant Glauber scaling, and there's the what is it called? What, binary collision? No. One is n part and the other is n col. And so they have different. Yes, and the other is binary conditions. Yeah. Yeah. And the point is that those have different. So those are slightly different, and they have a different dependence on centrality, if you want. So yeah. And if you put them into hydrodynamics, they give different results for your centrality dependence of multiplicity, for example. So you rule out those already because they just don't fit the data on multiplicity, which is the primary sort of constraint that you have on your initial condition.
But it should be emphasized that this whole discussion is some caricature, where on the one hand you start with some picture of your nuclei just before they collide, what we know about their density profile.
That would absolutely be.
And then you jump ahead in time about a Fermi over C, where you say now it's appropriate to model the system as a nearly ideal fluid, completely ignoring whatever interesting physics might have taken place, which we know has to take place in that intermediate period.
It is parameterized. This step is parameterized. It's not theoretically right. They say when you collide M nucleons and M nucleons together, there is some formula which tells you what is the entropy of infinity zero. And there's some smooth formula. Yes? So there is uncertainty in that formula.
But I thought you were more asking about the system evolution between time zero and the hydrodynamic starting time. Is that what you're asking about?
Yeah,
Well, I'm just pointing out that that's really there.
Yeah, sure.
That's the subject of this
part of the collision. We probably understand the worst.
Yeah,
yes, yes, I would agree. So what do you suggest of doing for that first time step?
That I do not have a good answer to.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I don't either. That's the problem. But I still want to do physics. So I still want to try as good a job as I can. So I take the input data for which some models exist. For example, as Edward was pointing out, this model where you have your Wood-Sachsen potential and you calculate what the entropy is in your initial state at the time where the two nuclei collide. Then you can also take, for example, these Kolar-Glass condensate models where people at least can use some classical gauge theory evolution that was done, for example, by Thomas Lappi. And, well, the model he used basically agrees fairly well with the global model at about, I don't know, half a fermi over C or one fermi over C. So, but then you might still say, well, that's just classical evolution, so there could be quantum effects. There probably will be quantum effects. So, yes, we really don't know. And unless somebody comes along with a good idea to make progress on that, we just have to take what we have, which is not much.
So jumping back to what you said a moment ago, if you're going to get serious about looking at fluctuations, doesn't that mean you also have to get serious about rapidity dependence and jump up in dimension?
Rapidity and system size. Normally,
yeah, systems and
economic rapidity and system size are sort of related.
Well, system size and centrality, etc., it is playing on the same kind of issues, right? You can either go to more peripheral and make smaller number of nuclei, so make smaller nuclei with the central collision.
Not, I don't know. I mean, it certainly would be. Well, so first of all, imagine that I can really apply this picture of a really, really high energy collision to RIG. Then the fluctuations I'm interested in are fluctuations occurring in the transverse plane where, well, my nuclei are not
so
nice.
Arbitrarily high energy and arbitrarily large nuclei.
No, not arbitrarily large nuclei. Finite size nuclei, which instead of being perfectly spherical, have some fuzziness. And this fuzziness, of course, will give me event-by-event fluctuations of eccentricity and hence V2. It is
but
true.
Fluctuations are surely it is not perfectly correlated
yes.
in rapidity.
Yes,
so
that's true.
The physics of those fluctuations has got to involve their decorrelation as you move in rapidity.
That may be true, yeah. But on the other hand, if you want to go to fully three-dimensional system evolution, it's true you can then handle these sorts of correlations over rapidities, but what sort of distribution do you put in for the geometric profile of your initial state, if you want, the rapidity dependence of your initial state. So you have to model that then somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But people did full 3D in ideal hydro.
Yeah.
Yes, the dependence on rapidity is rather boring linear dependence, similar to the dependence which Paul had shown for the function of collision energy. This data, different data,
yeah.
Is kind of linearly
rising.
So the same thing happens in the function of rapidity as you move forward. Because there are less particles.
Yeah, but you still have to model it somehow.
Exciting kind of
dependence of geometry,
of the initial geometry. after iteration is interesting, actually.
Because somehow the solid has the same eccentricity as all profinities in some sense. But, okay, that was the data.
I don't see, I mean, my intuition is you know, Arnold is not another one.
Because eventually we come to profinity when there's nothing left.
Is that, see, this thing is here is more pushed towards one nucleus and this towards another, so in the end you get something like this, so it has a bigger epsilon to start with. And then if you go towards one end, so this would be mid, and if you went towards the...
The geometry a little changes.
Towards, let's say, one of the nuclei, it would become something like this. And actually maybe it would be one.
There is
V1. There should be there, but I mean this...
V1 was measured.
I know, but I mean, without measurement, this is what I would expect for the initial conditions. And then how this depends on repetition, I don't know. I mean, if you have one, some of them.
Yeah, the thing becomes asymmetric. It is only completely symmetric in mean, rapidity, and there is no odd harmonics, but forward, backward, there is. And V1 was measured. I don't know what exactly.
Yeah, so that's, yeah, so to reiterate, I mean, it's definitely a good idea to sort of try to include the physics that depends on your rapidity. But there's then another layer of model-dependent issues that you have to also to put in, and that, yeah.
There was, for completeness, there was also Peter Kolb, just before he quit physics, he got a very interesting, so he calculated in Hydro V4 also, and you can calculate it with predictions, etc., but then from experimental point of view, the fluctuation of V2 and V4 were not really separated well, and that somehow didn't amount to much. In principle, there is calculation of V1, I haven't seen. Probably it is there in this 3+1Z. How can it not be?
I haven't seen it either, but
I haven't seen it.
Actually. I don't know, it might be
it
there.
Probably is in the code.
I guess so too, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the upshot is that this is some sort of dirty business. The hydrodynamic part itself is the cleanest part of it, I would say.
So what do you think is going to change in the next few years?
He means hydro. He means just asymmetric initial condition and not the same time.
Yeah, but the initial conditions is something that is not really part of the hydrodynamic equations, right? So.
But would you then say it's worth staying with ideal hydro and trying to pursue these type of questions? Because going to non-ideal hydro is not going to work, right?
Yes. But I mean, I guess you.
Are comparable. At least for some observables. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you really want to make progress on understanding data, I don't see any other way of going to viscous hydrodynamics in three dimensions. So.
So what do you want to do next?
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, I mean, I would like to see whether one can get some information out of these fluctuations, even though there might be a rapidity dependence that I'm not able to model. But yeah, I guess until one has tried it, one doesn't know whether one can really say something about it. I mean, it can be that it's the V2 fluctuations turn out to be completely insensitive, if you want, so to changes in, if you change at the same time viscosity and initial conditions. So that would be kind of boring. But it may be that they are sensitive just in the right way that one can try to make statements about it. And that is, at least possible to attempt with existing codes and techniques. On the other hand, yeah.
Well, at some point, you'd have to include other operators.
cannot satisfy uniform invariance. Okay, well, viscosity is always forcing that, but that's...
You got a long task.
Well, maybe there's one within that long list.
Yeah, sure, I mean...
I
So I should maybe say, yeah, this is not a thing that I can do myself, yeah. So I cannot do everything at the same time. So this is a has to be some other groups in the community, and there are other groups in the community, fortunately, who are now implementing viscous hydrodynamic codes. And eventually, yeah, one has to include also effects from bulk viscosity. One has to include effects from chemical potential, chemical non-equilibrium. One has eventually to go to three-dimensional simulations. So there's a lot of work to do. So. But you're right, so that there are.
It's one term.
It's probably not one. It's one term at first order, yeah, but then you get the same problems again. Good, so maybe I should still talk a little bit about what was announced, even though, yeah, well, let's just do that. So I wanted to give you a few thoughts about what turbulence or fluid turbulence might have to do with this picture here. And for that, I start by writing down the Reynolds number, which I parameterize as the energy density, or let's for relativistic systems immediately go to the enthalpy, energy density plus pressure, times the typical size of the system times typical velocity divided by the shear viscosity. So that's standard fluid dynamics, and you can ask what is this Reynolds number good for? Well, it tells you what is the difference, or what the properties of your flow are, whether it's laminar or whether it's turbulent. And I should add that for small Reynolds numbers, typically the flow is laminar, whereas at large Reynolds numbers, typically you develop turbulent flow. And the critical Reynolds number, where this transition from laminar to turbulent flow occur, are for boundary layers on the order of 10 to 5 to 10 to 6. And for flow in a circular pipe, they're on the order of maybe 2,000. So this is sort of the range of things that you can see in actual everyday physics, if you want to. And the question I wanted to ask is, what is the Reynolds number at RIG? And could it be that if it's sort of at least larger, very much larger than one, that we have to deal with effects from turbulence? So yeah, let's do this first exercise to get the Reynolds number at RIG. What do we have to do? Well, energy density plus pressure, I can write down as entropy density times the temperature. Typical length of my system, well, maybe on the order of 5-6 Fermi. The typical velocity, well, they are probably close to the speed of light. So in my units, they are on the order of 1, maybe half, something like that.
0.7
at the H. 0.7, order 1. I'm only interested in orders of magnitude. And, well, the viscosity is the viscosity. So then I recognize this nice relation here, eta over S, the inverse of it. And, well, let's just plug in some numbers. If I plug in the value from Policastro's on and Sternetz, I get 4 pi. The typical temperature, well, let's say it's about 200 MeV, which is about 0.2 GeV, which is about, it's an inverse Fermi. So you have an inverse Fermi times 6 Fermi, so you get a factor of 6 from here. So you get something on the order of maybe 24 times pi, it's on the order of 60 or something. If you believe Glaube initial conditions, the value you get out from, or the value that seems to be favored from data is even below that, maybe 1 over 8 pi. So I would argue that this is on the order of maybe 100, maybe below factor of 2, maybe above factor of 2, something.
It's really kind of where is the concept in non-relativistic?
Yeah.
And so there might be some issue.
Well, so I mean, as I said, I mean the flow velocities are on the order of 1 in units of speed of light, but they are not ultra relativistic. They are not 0.999 in units of c.
But in principle, you may ask how this is there. He has term with eta and term without eta. So this ratio of the two terms in the equation is roughly the same.
Yes.
Well.
Yes. Yes. So.
It makes sense.
I mean, if you look at the critical Reynolds number that we have in everyday systems, you would say, well, it's definitely smaller than that. But if you look at the range of, well, this is, as I said, it's boundary layer. This is a flow in a circular pipe. I'm not so sure what the critical Reynolds number for the QGP has to be. At least 100 is larger than 1.
It's independent of QGP. It depends on geometry of expansion. It is,
yes.
For example,
yes.
Kind of linear Hubble flow.
Yes.
Very, very stable.
Yeah, anyways, so I became interested in what would happen if I had turbulence in a heavy ion collision setting, something like that. And that's what I briefly wanted to mention.
Your personal conclusion be that we don't need to worry about it?
So I actually put a paper on the archive speculating what happens if turbulence develops. I'm myself kind of, let's say, skeptical whether it really would develop in a weak heavy ion collisions at least. But I don't know. So.
Looks like a missing criteria.
So what would be the signature then?
Yes, that's what I'm trying to tell you. So first of all, I should say that
the pipes with water start making sounds.
The pipes there.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that so what happens typically in turbulence, if I look at the spectrum as a function of k, so for example, the velocity correlator in Fourier space, then I have a regime which, well, at low wave numbers, I have a geometric flow, which typically is laminar. And this will occur up to wave numbers of about 1 over the size of the system. Then I will have a region which is, if turbulence is there, will be turbulent. And that will be a scale invariant region until I reach at about the Reynolds number over the length of the system, a region where dissipation, microscopic dissipation, actually occurs, and this is where the scale invariance breaks once more. And the interesting thing is that you can now imagine a situation where, for heavy ion collisions at least, well, you have your two nuclei here, and even though on the sort of large scale size of the system, the thing looks smooth, there might be some small fluctuations inside your system, which have a small wavelength, high momentum. And these might be smaller than, for example, what I typically can resolve in a viscous hydrodynamic simulation. Meaning that if I have my grid here, the grid is not as large, but that. But
aren't you contradicting your own picture? Your picture has maximum small k, right? So it means that the main turbulence is a small k, and then it is not sitting somewhere large k.
The largest eddies are always the same size. So
So there would be largest eddies of the order of the size of the system. Because I agree with your plot.
The previous part?
This one, that it can curve, and the maximum is a small k.
Yes, but
the largest vortices has the largest amplitude.
Yes, that may be true, but I didn't say what the size of these largest eddies were. So they could be sort of.
And now we start saying, what about something which you don't resolve?
Yes.
Way?
Yes.
This is the opposite end.
Yeah, that point is it might start as a very small eddy, and then it might cascade to the IR. That's what I'm trying to say. And the reason for that is simply, let me just say it once more. So I can start, or it could be that I have very small fluctuations on sub-grid scales in some sense. And those eddies then will influence my behavior of my, well, the modes that I can resolve on my grid. And the point is that within this business of heavy ion collisions, the geometry is such that I have my two nuclei coming together on the longitudinal axis, and they smash into each other such that I have basically all my interesting physics happening in this transverse plane here, whereas I assume a sort of Bjorken expansion along the longitudinal axis. So in that sense, the dynamics of my heavy ion collision is the one that is important for elliptic flow, for example, is purely two-dimensional with a geometric flow that doesn't oscillate whatsoever in the longitudinal direction. So why is that important? It's important because 2D turbulence is qualitatively different from 3D turbulence. So in 2D turbulence, or let me first say in 3D turbulence, what you typically have is what Edward just said. You start out with eddies at a very large scale. Those eddies basically excite smaller and smaller eddies, and there's a direct cascade of energy from the infrared to the UV. In 2D, interestingly, this cascade is inversed. There's an inverse cascade feeding energy into the system from the UV, and the cascade happens in the opposite direction. And this thing manifests itself as, well, basically having small eddies on subscript scales will then influence my behavior on the large scales. And one can actually calculate or try to calculate what the effect of that is. And the way you do that is by, you have to model somehow what the turbulence behavior at these high wave numbers are. But then you can just take your hydrodynamic equations and calculate what is the corrections to your effective viscosity at low momentum scales. So what I'm trying to say is that, let me see.
In spite of the fact that we start from left and start from right, and of course in 2D and 3D there are these Kolmogorov spectral, which is only different, yet it is still true that the maximal amplitude is a small k, right? And they always have
the same. But there are many of them at high k.
So you will expect a very large amplitude, large edges. Yeah, I'm leading to the idea that if there would be something like this, the first thing which will go will be our electricity.
Yeah.
Because it starts being turbulent. Mm-hmm.
So the point is,
we will kill our main golden rules.
Let me just say that, and then you can go on with your criticism. So the point is, you can calculate the effective viscosity due to the turbulence. So the you have your typical viscosity eta, and you add to that some eddy viscosity that you calculate by just averaging over these eddies that you have in your subscript scales. And the point is that you can calculate that in d dimensions, and this eddy viscosity then will be proportional to something that, well, in d dimensions is d squared minus d minus 4 over 8d d plus 2. And I neglected, for example, the typical scales and things like that. But yeah, the important thing to notice is here that if I put in three space dimensions, I get 9 minus 3 is 6, minus 2 is 2 for d equals 3 in the numerator. Whereas for two dimensions, I have 4 minus 2 is 2, minus 4 is minus 2. So the important thing to note is that in three-dimensional turbulence, I get an enhancement of my viscosity, which tells me that the turbulence will kill my elliptic flow. Whereas in two dimensions, I get a decrease of my effective viscosity, which means that I get an effective viscosity which is smaller than the microscopic viscosity.
So it's not that kills my viscosity, it kills by the fact that would be eddies of the size of the system, and
I'm taking that into account by averaging over these modes, or these turbulent modes.
The average orthogonal, and then there's no direction or something. It could be isotropic.
Yes, it's isotropic in 2D.
But we still
in this regime.
Right, like if you have turbulent atmospheres, everything is isotropic in average, right? I'm saying you will kill the overall V2.
But V2, the geometric flow is not directly affected by turbo. It just proceeds its usual course.
Why not? It is a very large amplitude.
Well, so at some scales, those largest eddies basically have to stop. I don't know what the largest eddy scale is. That I don't know. If it's really on the order of the system size, you might eventually be right. But
in tubes, by the way, it immediately change how much flow goes through the tube and things like this. So it change everything by factor one.
In what? In tubes?
In tubes, for example, laminar flow or turbulent.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just wanted to. But usually, I mean, you would expect that this comes through the fact that you effectively increase your viscosity from the microscopic value to some much larger value that comes through the effect of turbulence, essentially. But what I'm saying here is that, yeah, so in two dimensions it minus, and it actually decreases the viscosity. And that, well, in some case, well, so first I should add this concept is still being used by engineers who design airplanes and things like that. But the metrologists who originally put that forward in the 60s, they eventually replaced it by a more refined picture of wave turbulence. What?
It's used for airplanes, it must work.
Yeah, I'm saying there's something you can do, not mistakes first and then it.
Yeah, so.
But this negative viscosity is really means that what used to be a diffusion mode is now negative height.
No, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be the whole contribution should better still be large or equal to zero, because otherwise, yeah, as I say, something else takes over. But it can be. That's different from what I'm talking about. It's not the primary turbulent instability. So if the whole, so the sum between the microscopic and the eddy viscosity goes below zero, then typically that means that, well, higher point functions come into play and will regulate that eventually. But yeah, so this kind of 2D turbulence has this funny effect that it reduces your effective viscosity that you have in your system. And well, I just wanted curious that if something like that occurs in heavy ion collisions, it might have a signal pretty close to what we see, namely that we find this very small ratio of eta over s, which, if it turns out to be, well, that the right initial condition that gives us this, we have to explain somehow, right? And you can either say, yeah, the bound by Kofton, Sond, and Starinitz is wrong, or, well, you have to come up with another idea. So the thing that I wanted to emphasize is that if that is really true, then if you go to the LHC, you would expect that, well, if there's turbulence developing in the LHC, you have a longer evolution time, so you give it more time for this turbulent phase to happen, which would mean that, well, you can, in some sense, expect an even bigger decrease of your effective viscosity. So one thing that one could imagine there is that indeed you drive your effective viscosity, so the sum of the microscopic and eddy viscosity, very close to zero. So that would mean that, well, you should find a maximal signal close to or maybe even above the ideal hydrodynamic result for LHC. So, yeah, it's
Sorry, in your hydro simulations, you're in the laminar.
Yes.
Of course, yeah.
But yeah, so one can estimate what is the size of this eddy viscosity that would be allowed, because I resolve certain grid spacings and then I can calculate how much effect would that give. And it can possibly change it by a factor of 2. But yeah.
This means that this eddies will be confined to the conscious plane.
Yes.
And not.
Yes, not three-dimensional. Whenever it turns fully three-dimensional, then it goes the other way.
And why the calculation don't become turbulent because of numerical viscosity?
No, because I don't resolve small grid scales.
Yeah, but that means that all this, you think of this viscosity as being ultraviolet somehow, that it is beyond your cutoff.
Yeah.
That's not the right way. It is an infrared phenomenon. It will change your flow in hydrogen. But you say it's not 3D.
Yeah.
But the only difference is in which direction it starts, but somehow it is still the largest amplitude is a small case, so it will, you will see turbulent behavior in your calculation in principle.
Yes, I agree with that. If I put it on a large enough computer and have the right initial spectrum of fluctuations, which I also don't have, then I could in principle test that.
Yeah, you can. If you add a little bit noise to initial condition, you can know
the pattern. Doesn't there have to be an instability in the spectrum? If you linearize, you can linearize it in any solution. There must be a turbulent instability.
Yeah, but you have to linearize it around the geometrical flow.
Yeah.
And the geometric flow, you don't have an analytic solution. You only have a numeric solution.
Yeah.
But instead of linearized
noise,
we can add noise to initial condition and see what happens.
But in principle, there would need a mesh which is a Reynolds number.
Yes, that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very fine mesh, which I cannot afford.
So I must say, I don't have any intuition as to whether it would originate in the ultraviolet or the infrared.
But independent where it originated, it has stable Kolmogorov type behavior, which has some powers of k and so on.
Right, but the question
the maximal amplitude is always at small k.
But the question is, where it would originate in this kind of scheme?
Yeah, it would originate at the UV. And it would then cascade downwards, essentially.
And the reason is because the higher derivative terms are becoming dominant.
Kind of discretizations.
Let's assume we can discretize, as much as we want. We have big enough computer. I'm just trying to understand physically.
Yeah,
you would have the layers sliding on each other, indiscriminately. Layers, like, basically, in the ideal hydro, you can have a layer by layer, like on a soap.
Yeah.
So I think this would happen. And the system would break up into those layers, and then they would start curling up on a short scale, curling up.
The most classic system is that you have, for example, two rotating cylinders and the flow in between, and then at some particular value, there are edges, appears, and few, and then more, and they're still stable for a while. Yes. The original laminar is unstable, but then another is stable, and then more and more complicated, and finally develop turbulence. So it's not necessarily, instability is not necessarily correspond to large k, correspond to modes which, on the contrary, are large size. Yes? Some other big size eddies which start to be excited.
Bigger or not, but the interfaces between them are
bigger because you see the critical Reynolds number has L upstairs. So when you reach it, you first reach it for the largest L. The largest mode first reach the critical Reynolds at large L, which means the largest eddies reach that first.
Well, except it's L times U.
Yeah.
And what does U mean?
It's the velocity.
What does it really mean? So it's velocity with respect to some boundary which we don't have.
Yeah.
So really, presumably, you can erase both of those and just put in a gradient U.
Yes. Yeah, you have to put in something else again. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, I still think that we should start from like that. For Uber, this instability is a problem, let's start from that.
Yeah, you might be right. Could be true. I don't know.
Now,
there's literature about establishment of tolerance and what people need for tolerance.
Yeah, there's not.
What happens around critical areas?
There's not too much on, well, there is now more interest in two-dimensional turbulence, but most interest is, of course, in three-dimensional turbulence. And the two are really qualitatively different. So
you're solving two-dimensional equations, and there's no dependence on relativity, I understand. But,
yeah.
You know, turbulence love to violate symmetries you impose in your solution.
Yeah, but
for instance, if you look how these power law solutions would evolve when you start from some early universe in quantum dynamics, you take parametric instabilities or spinodal instabilities, then it's not in the infrared, neither in the UV. It's some intermediate range where these power law solutions
start. Also, yeah, and it exists always in between.
I mean, there most of it is known because it has been studied in great detail.
Here there's no disagreement that the spectrum look like this.
So that's then more dependent.
Yeah, I'm not arguing where it even starts. I'm saying that the spectrum look like this, like he told. And the maximal amplitude is a small k.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter where it starts. Which means that we really see some terrible thing at the scale L of the whole fireball.
So at least after a certain time, the maximum is always a very low.
Right, and that will keep on magnetic flow.
That's called stirring your cup of coffee.
Sorry? Mm. Yes, let's think.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the reason why I got interested in that in the first place was that there was no treatment, or I could find no treatment of turbulence for relativistic systems, or relativistic fluids, I should specify, in the first place. So, I don't know. It's just curious. Because, after all, I mean, this is, I mean, you take your ideal fluid dynamics equations, and well, you can ask what if turbulence would develop, what would be the signal that I get out of it? And it sort of surprised me that that had not been done before, because it turns out you can calculate that for a relativistic equation of state. You can, well, so at least I couldn't calculate it for ultra relativistic velocities, but maybe you can find a way around that. But well, at least a well-defined problem. What would the Kolmogorov spectrum look for a relativistic fluid if turbulence develops?
If you talk about wave turbulence, then you can see this inversion function expression of the field. It has the time.
But you don't get a stationary solution there?
Pumping energy.
Yeah.
Or,
I see.
We have a flux of energy, constant flux of energy across the system, or it's stationary.
In those early universe applications, it gets the energy from a large field expectation value that decays.
Yeah.
So there's no real source or sink in this original picture of Kolmogorov.
Well, there is.
And also,
you still have a pumping,
pumping into this could,
but it's just a decay of the inflaton.
Okay. So inflaton pulse here, and the viscosity finally put it in heat, right?
In hybrid the inflaton, that's the difference exchanging energy with it, like coupled by one oscillator, and you have the frequency of the oscillations, which is more or less one.
And I'm also a bit puzzled now by this comparison with the universe calculations. You say, if you look at this boundary at the UV, you made an arrow to the left. So the
yes, that's for the 2D.
Power law solution shrinks.
No, this is not meant to signify that the power law, that the region actually shrinks. It's more that in 2D you have this cascade that goes from the UV to the IR.
Just to clarify, when you say 2D.
Yeah.
Do I need to distinguish whether I'm thinking really of a 2D system or a 3D system that has no dependence on one dimension?
Yes, that's the latter. So a 3D system that has no dimensions on, no dependence on the fluctuation dynamics on the third dimension.
Somehow vortices interact logarithmically.
Yeah, if it's really 2D, then the non-linearities are such that transport coefficients are scale dependent, they don't really exist in the conventional sense.
So if you want 3D, but all vertices are strictly parallel to each other, etc., it is still, in that sense,
flux tubes. Actually, I'll show you some of the simulations where magnetic fields are produced and the size of the flux tubes grow. So they're moving to the left.
Right. You see that?
I'm in 3D. Probably accretion to some black hole have relativistic flows.
Yeah, I thought so too, but
with some turbulence.
So
nobody knew.
I couldn't find it. That doesn't mean that nobody did it. So. But I could find a lot of literature in atmospheric sciences in the 70s. There are seemingly people interpreted this inverse cascade really as a negative viscosity, and there are people who did that. Nowadays, people say that's too crude. They have a very wave turbulence picture that replaced these sort of eddy viscosities, but the same physics in a very crude sense is still there. So. And I was puzzled that I couldn't find that, for example, in astrophysics, in neutral fluid turbulence, if you want.
I'm sure there must be some in quasars, the accretion disks around the black hole.
Yeah.
But nobody understands.
Yeah, the modeling is not,
modeling is
not very sophisticated.
It's far from realistic.
I mean, they don't have turbulence yet. At least those systems are very macroscopic, so of course the Reynolds number can be huge in principle, right? L.
To my knowledge, nobody's doing that sophisticated
simulations
with viscous hydro and turbulence and all of that.
The furthest they do is just look for the acceleration among different sheets of the accretion disk. Mm-hmm. See whether they radiate the way we see the accretion radiating.
Leave it at that.
So tomorrow we switch to the auditorium for